26. Getting Real with Meditation and Visualization. The previous two chapters discussed methods of visualization, breathing, and meditation. Here we incorporate these practices with two techniques to help us break free from even decades-old resentment, encased anger that encrusts us long after the situation has passed. It's normal to think about a painful experience long after it has passed, to process it, to work through it, and perhaps to gain some insight, meaning, or message. The question researchers sought to explain is why it works sometimes and we feel better, while other times we become stuck and the negativity becomes more intensely ingrained. They write, "Although engaging in this meaning-making process leads people to feel better at times, it frequently breaks down, leading people to ruminate and feel worse. This raises the question, what factors determine whether people's attempts to work through their negative feelings succeed or fail?" The answer to this question is concisely summarized by psychologist Guy Winch, who explains that we tend to think about painful experiences from a first-person, ego-oriented perspective, just as we experienced it unfolding through our own eyes. However, replaying the emotionally painful memories from a third-person perspective, where we are a witness to the scene, watching ourselves, as it were, from the perspective of an outside observer, produces a profound effect. He writes, "Participants reported feeling significantly less emotional pain when they envisioned the memory using a third-person perspective than when using a first-person perspective. Further, utilizing a psychologically distant vantage point also allowed them to reconstruct their understanding of their experiences and reach new insights and feelings of closure." The findings dovetail with the essence of our discussion. The more I we bring into an unpleasant event, the more pain we feel. Likewise, we sink more deeply into the negativity when we remember it from our own, the first-person perspective. It is, as we know, not the situation or event that makes us angry, but the degree to which we take it personally. This technique, credited to the science of neuro-linguistic programming, engages the power of visualization to depersonalize the impact, producing a permanent shift in our feelings toward any situation. The Perceptual Positions Exercise. 1. Find a quiet place where you can relax undisturbed. Close your eyes and get comfortable. 2. Recall an experience that you feel anger about. 3. This is where you consider the situation from your own perspective, through your own eyes, as if you were looking at the other person and/or scene. How are you behaving? How are you feeling? What do you see? What do you believe about the situation? Feel the effects on your body, the tightness, the physical tension, and the accompanying feelings, and simply observe. 4. Next, zoom out and view the situation as if you are an observer, replaying the scene once more. Talk to yourself and think about why this person is so angry. As we know, anger is rooted in the themes of fear and control. Ask yourself, what exactly am I afraid of? What is the underlying fear behind the anger? What need of mine is not being met? Spend as much time as you'd like examining your behavior and underlying motivation. 5. Now we will integrate a brief relaxation exercise to help us own our revised feelings. Feel your body and breathe. Bring in the two exercises in the previous chapter on deep breathing and progressive muscle relaxation. 6. Come back into yourself and spend a few moments appreciating your choice to do something about the anger, to release it rather than to let it define you and confine you. Smile. The following NLP, neuro-linguistic programming exercise, is an enhanced spin-off of the previous technique and changes our internal representation by stripping away the intensity of the associated emotions. It accomplishes this through a dual psychological and physiological mechanism, which is explained afterward. The movie exercise. 1. Find a quiet place where you can relax undisturbed. Close your eyes and get comfortable. 2. Picture yourself sitting alone inside of a movie theater, front row and center. The screen is frozen on the first frame of the movie, and it is in black and white. The first frame is a picture of you in a situation where you were previously angry. You are about to relive this moment with two visual and auditory differences, one from another vantage point, and two with an incongruent, amusing soundtrack. 3. Imagine that you're floating out of your body and into the projection booth so that you can see yourself from the back inside of the cinema and watching the screen ahead. Take a moment to take in the scene, how you're sitting, the clothes that you're wearing. 4. Now replay the memory on the screen ahead while listening to an amusing soundtrack, such as a cartoon theme or of some comedic melody. Pay attention to not only the screen, but to yourself watching the screen. 5. When you get past what is the worst of this experience, freeze the film. Float inside the movie and view everything through your own eyes, replaying it as above with the incongruent soundtrack. Afterward, run the movie at high speed, then again backward, in color, with you experiencing it in the first person. You will see everything happening in reverse. People and things will walk, talk, and move backward. The same soundtrack will play backward at top speed, and the whole movie will be over quickly. Replay the scene again, and this time more quickly, and then again, with the last replay taking no more than 5 seconds. 6. When you reach the beginning of the movie, black out the screen. 7. Repeat steps 5 and 6 once or twice more until you feel little or no anger toward the person or the experience. This technique works by disrupting our internal representation of the event, inhibiting the intensity of emotion, and neutralizing the negative association. Research finds that our memories are highly malleable and possibly never completely solidify, which means that we can strengthen or weaken them at any time. When we experience a trauma, our feelings of terror and vulnerability intensify, stimulating output of adrenaline. It is the adrenaline that keeps these memories strong and intense, even days, months, or years after the event. Scientists have experimented with the drug propranolol, a beta blocker usually used to treat heart or circulatory conditions, and shown to block the production of adrenaline in nerve cells of the amygdala. Findings showed that people who received this adrenaline-blocking drug while recalling a past trauma could form a new association to the event and release themselves from the emotional pain. The above-described technique is used to achieve similar results by stripping away the negative charge of any anger or fear-inducing experience. 27. In the heat of the moment. Anger management techniques often fail because they are the first line of defense. We simply get worn down and worn out too easily. As the saying goes, the best defense is a good offense, which is why our focus has been on how to avoid the need to manage our anger. With perspective, we do not have to force ourselves to remain calm when, for instance, faced with insult, because there is no pain. One does not have to fight against that which he knows to be irrelevant, much less false. Then, regardless of how low our state and how large our ego becomes in the heat of the moment, we will not succumb to anger. What does not exist cannot grow. In the previous chapters, we explained how the brain can change, rewiring itself to establish new neural pathways through the process called self-directed neuroplasticity. Via visualization, we get the proverbial ball rolling, and as we enter the real world, the following protocol will reinforce this new wiring, because to become anger-free as quickly as possible, we want to limit reanimating the neurons in the anger response pathway. Let's be smart. First, we want to identify when we're most at risk of going off course. When we know our triggers, we can limit the number of times we wind up facing anger-provoking scenarios. Some critical junctures, times when we're most vulnerable to falling into familiar patterns, are situation-specific, time-specific, and people-specific. If we take a detour to avoid confronting temptation, our route might be slightly longer, but we'll have a better chance of arriving safely at our destination anger-free. We should acknowledge our limitations to prevent ourselves from slipping too close to these danger zones. When we're not in the right frame of mind or don't have emotional energy to expend, it's prudent to avoid potentially confrontational conversations and situations. Moreover, it's foolish to unnecessarily drain our emotional resources. Controlling anger requires willpower, and willpower is not an infinite resource. We temporarily deplete it each time we act with restraint. For example, studies found that if we resist a persuasive message, this decreases our ability to exercise self-control right afterward, and this depletion increases our vulnerability to persuasion. Research concludes that people who most successfully exercise self-control usually set up their lives to minimize temptations during the day. Protocol, Level 1. When our ability to think clearly, or at all, is compromised, we too easily default to autopilot and fall into familiar, self-defeating, emotionally charged patterns. Setting up a protocol in advance, a prearranged course of action to follow, lets us react responsibly when we can't think and process a proper response. This is effective even when our willpower reserves are drained, because we don't have to think about what to do. In other words, our visceral reaction can be primed so that our response is thoughtful, even though it is instinctive. The protocol in Level 1 consists of two intertwining layers, which we'll outline and then flesh out. First, we interrupt the anger-producing pattern to stop the stimulus-response cycle from becoming more ingrained. The interruption also moves us further away from reacting angrily because, physiologically, it sends a biochemical signal to the nervous system to disengage the fight-or-flight response. Second, the best thing about this level is that this type of interruption relies on muscle memory, no brains necessary. In the following pages, we will discuss this concept more fully. But for now, consider muscle memory as the key behind near-flawless and near-automated performance, such as typing by an experienced typist or driving a stick shift by a seasoned driver. Pattern interrupt. When our emotions veer onto the anger track, we want to derail our train of thought as quickly as possible, by whatever reasonable means possible. A pattern interrupt does just this. It quickly jolts our focus to keep the locomotive from picking up steam toward an unproductive reaction. A pattern interrupt can be any incongruent thought or gesture, snapping one's fingers, visualizing the person we're speaking to shrinking, counting backward in threes, and so on. However, we will see that one type of pattern interrupt is superior to all. Interruptions also dampen the intensity of the original stimulus, thereby neutralizing the damage. The automated muscle memory response. There are four levels to every type of action. 1. Unconscious incompetence is when a person is unaware that he is not performing correctly. 2. Conscious incompetence is when the person is aware of not having the skill set necessary to be as effective and successful as he would like to be. 3. Conscious competence is when the person knows but must pay attention to what he needs to do in order to be effective. And 4, unconscious competence is when the person can perform correctly and as necessary without full or even partial attention. Learning to drive a stick shift effectively illustrates the 4 levels. At first, it feels completely foreign, but the driver eventually has the skill to shift gears without consciously focusing on what he is doing. The process is now integrated into muscle memory and can be instinctually performed. Muscle memory is related to procedural memory, which is a type of unconscious long-term memory that helps us perform specific tasks with minimal attention. And we can automatically access procedural memories without conscious awareness. Putting it all together. Although many traditional tools of anger management don't work, one of them remains irrefutable. The principle of terror management reminds us that fear impedes our ability to think. Therefore, a powerful weapon in our willpower arsenal is simply to pause and calm ourselves by breathing deeply. This is effective for 2 reasons. Physiologically, willpower has a biological basis, and slow, deep breathing activates the prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain. Law enforcement and military professionals combat stress with tactical breathing, which helps control the sympathetic nervous system. During a life and death situation, several successive deep breaths help them to think more clearly and engage more effectively. The second reason is the previously mentioned facial feedback hypothesis. The very act of smiling, we'll explain this in a moment, and breathing deeply sends the message to the brain that the situation is non-threatening and that it's not only safe to relax, but that we are already relaxed. An incongruous expression or response compels the thinking brain to re-engage, to make sense of the conflicting emotions. Because the external awakens the internal, our feelings will align with our behavior instead of the opposite. Now we'll fold in all the psychological and physiological processes into 1 simple protocol. Whether you are thinking about a situation or you're in a situation that is anger or fear provoking, simultaneously smile, take a long, deep breath, and move your attention to your breath. Unclench your jaw, drop your shoulders, and just focus on your breathing. That's it. You need only smile ever so faintly, particularly if you're in the actual situation, as you don't want others to think you're being smug or disrespectful. When a person is anxious or angry, he may force a smile or breathe to calm himself, but doing both, smiling and breathing, gives us more than the physiological benefits of both. Together they do something almost magical. Accessing memories of simultaneous smiling and deep breathing, which are calming and pleasant, and anchoring us into this emotional state. It is important to emphasize that our attention is on our breath, becoming mindful of how it fills our lungs and then is released gently and slowly. Typically, an anger-provoking thought or situation narrows our focus to the source of discontent. Bringing awareness to our breath instantly grounds us and interrupts the escalation of emotions. Doing this will take some practice at first, but soon enough your response will be automated, and the moment an unwelcome thought pops up, or you find yourself in an emotionally precarious situation, your physiology will take over and free you from the grip of anger. When all is said and done, or better, when all is not said and not done, after the initial moment has passed and we have risen above the urge to get angry, we want to take pleasure in our success. Isn't it beautiful that I don't need to get angry anymore? Feel the joy when you choose to remain calm, or at least in control of yourself. This isn't about taking a victory lap. Joy infuses a positive emotional charge into the action of self-control, energizing our success and animating the new and improved neural network. Protocol Level 2. If you can think, What to say when you talk to yourself. Be real. Be honest. What you say to yourself in the heat of the moment tilts your emotional state and subsequent response. You must stay in the world of truth because any lie divides your energy and moves you into the world of falsehood, the home of the ego. You cannot, therefore, force yourself to think, "I am calm and I don't care." All you are doing is lying to yourself. This is one shortcoming of affirmations. Although they can certainly be powerful tools, reciting positive affirmations can be counterproductive when we're in a negative state because we charge the lie with energy. We are not whole when we suppress how we feel and deny the pain. If we feel angry, we must own that. But which part of us is angry? The ego or the soul? We feel angry, but it's not the real us. Rather, the false self feels angry. To maintain our authenticity while separating ourselves from the negative feeling, we instead acknowledge, "My ego is hurt. My ego is scared." Don't ignore the pain, but rather take a moment to remind yourself that you, the soul, is not in pain. Your false self is. Then ask yourself, honestly and lovingly, 1. What need of mine is not being met? Or perhaps, what am I afraid of? Anger and fear are interlaced, so if you're able to identify the underlying fear, you begin to gain control over your feelings. Remember that anger often serves as a mask for emotions the ego deems too painful to acknowledge. Guilt, insecurity, envy, jealousy, embarrassment, anxiety, unworthiness, emptiness, the list goes on. Then continue to talk to yourself. 2. What is my objective right now? 3. What can I control right now? 4. What can I say or do to find a solution or to better the situation? Even when self-examination yields no new insight, the process is useful because fear begins to dissipate the moment we begin to examine it. Hang on, help is on the way. Research shows that even in high-stress situations, we need no more than 90 seconds for our system to process any anger or fear-based emotion. This means we can clear out physiological influences and regain our full rational status in the most trying of circumstances. In My Stroke of Insight, Jill Bolte Taylor writes, "Although there are certain limbic system, emotional programs that can be triggered automatically, it takes less than 90 seconds for one of these programs to be triggered, surge through our body, and then be completely flushed out of our bloodstream. My anger response, for example, is a programmed response that can be set off automatically. Once triggered, the chemical released by my brain surges through my body and I have a physiological experience. Within 90 seconds from the initial trigger, the chemical component of my anger has completely dissipated from my blood, and my automatic response is over. If, however, I remain angry after those 90 seconds have passed, then it is because I have chosen to let that circuit continue to run. Moment by moment, I make the choice to either hook into my neurocircuitry or move back into the present moment, allowing that reaction to melt away as fleeting physiology. No matter how visceral our initial response is, the emotion can roll right through our nervous system in just 90 seconds. We feed it only through cognitive reinforcement, selling ourselves on an impossible lie that we can regain control by losing control. 28. The Magnitude of Gratitude. We explained how the brain establishes neural networks that reinforce emotional responses. To maximize anger control, we would do well to build up the surrounding networks that support and synergize a feeling of being calm and in control. Let's take a real-life metaphor. If a person has a damaged nerve in his leg, whereby the corresponding muscle is unable to receive a signal to contract and expand to facilitate walking, all is not lost. Certain therapies can help the patient build up the muscles around the nerve to compensate for the weakness. To create changes in the brain, we proactively engage in acts that build the shared networks, cause neurons to light up, and the dendrites or connections to strengthen. Of all the connections, one stands out as the one from which we get the greatest return on our investment: gratitude. Expect nothing and appreciate everything. The physiological and psychological benefits of gratitude are well documented. Those who kept gratitude journals on a weekly basis, exercised more regularly, reported fewer physical symptoms, felt better about their lives as a whole, and were more optimistic about the upcoming week compared to those who recorded hassles or neutral life events. They were more likely to have made progress toward important personal goals, academic, interpersonal, and health-based, and reported high-energy positive moods, a greater sense of feeling connected to others, more confidence about their lives, and better sleep duration and sleep quality relative to a control group. A study by psychologist Dr. Alex Wood, published in the Journal of Research in Personality, shows that gratitude can also reduce the frequency, duration, and intensity of depressive episodes. This is because giving and gratitude, which is itself giving thanks, redirect our attention away from ourselves. When we look for ways to say thanks instead of indulging what may be our more natural impulse to complain, we break down the neural net of anger, frustration, and resentment. The human mind can focus on only one thought at a time. If we focus on something that makes us appreciative, how likely is it that in that moment we will feel angry or unhappy? It's almost completely impossible. Gratitude is not simply a matter of looking at events through rose-colored glasses. The reticular activating system, RAS, the brain's filtering mechanism, which is located at the base of the brain, keeps us from being overwhelmed by unnecessary stimuli. Our objectives, and in some instances our fears, dictate what we deem important, and whether or not we unconsciously dismiss or consciously accept something. Our focus becomes our experience, our reality, and we decide what is brought into our purview. For example, when conversing at a cocktail party, you become aware of another conversation, and by shifting your attention, you can mute the person who is in front of you and pick up on what is being said further away. The reticular activating system hones in on what we deem important and creates connections and possibilities that would have remained otherwise dormant. Stop, reflect, and act. Reminding ourselves what we are grateful for and acknowledging this every day puts our focus on what we have rather than on what we lack. We then feel, we become, we are more fulfilled. Take a few minutes each day to reflect on and write down what you are thankful for in your life. Start with your most consistent blessings, perhaps those we too often take for granted: eyes to see, fingers to touch, food to eat, and clothing to wear. Don't overthink and don't analyze what you write. No erasing or crossing out. Just write down everything and everyone you are grateful for as the thoughts come to mind. Now, each morning, spend a few minutes reading your gratitude list. Whenever you are so inclined, or better still, when you are less inclined, add to the list. And always remember to take a moment to appreciate what didn't happen or what didn't go wrong. Look for gratitude in every area of your life, and you'll begin to reap the benefits of a different quality of life. Recall from Chapter 8 that gratitude and joy are intimately linked. If we think about the people we know who have a sense of gratitude, we realize they're the same ones who are joyful. By contrast, those who lack appreciation usually live in a cycle of unrealized expectations and perpetual disappointment. Moreover, consider putting an attitude of gratitude into action by not just thinking about things you are grateful for, but speaking and behaving like a grateful person. When you conduct yourself in this way, the grateful mindset more easily permeates your nature. Have in mind to take note, in real time, of 5 pleasant things that happen to you each day, things that you might have previously ignored or shrugged off without much thought. In the midst of each event, spend just 7 seconds or so in appreciation. Here are 3 other proven strategies to help transform yourself into a person of gratitude. Yet equally important is to take a mental step back by taking a few moments each morning to reflect on who we are, what we are living for, and why. This helps focus your thoughts, feelings, and behaviors on what is important, so that distractions and potential frustrations fall naturally into proper perspective. Notes of gratitude. Find a quiet moment to pen a letter to someone to whom you feel especially grateful. Make sure to include as many positive details as possible about how this person has had an impact on your life. It is best to deliver this letter in person and not on a specific occasion, such as a birthday or anniversary, but just because. If you do, you will be privileged to witness the individual's surprise, delight, and reciprocation of affection and gratitude. This will serve to enhance your own gratitude, leading you to do this more often, even for those with whom you may have lost contact, and to continue to appreciate all the qualities you admire about this individual and others as well. If you're not much of a writer, don't fret. A phone call or face-to-face conversation is also effective. Walks of gratitude. Take a walk outdoors. It doesn't matter if there's a light drizzle or a shining sun, cold or warm outside. Gear up and go. As you walk, take the time to admire the beautiful outdoors, the warm and shining sun, the dew-drenched green grass, the sounds of nature, the bright blue sky. If it's evening, cast your eyes upwards to the majesty of the night sky. Take a moment to enjoy the unparalleled perspective and humility found only in the magnificence of creation, billions of galaxies in a vast universe, and ourselves. As you continue to walk, contemplate all the blessings in your life and your ability to appreciate all these blessings. Begin walking briskly, becoming mindful of your beating heart, swinging arms, feet hitting the ground at a steady pace, steady but rapid breathing. This integrates a powerful physiological component that reinforces our emotional state. Now slow down, and as you make your way back home, take a moment to enjoy who you are. A person who takes time out to acknowledge what he has. A person of gratitude. Montage of gratitude. Put together a montage, collage, or assortment of pictures, photographs, and quotes of gratitude. Once a week, or once a day, it should not be a chore, set aside a picture of something that brings a smile to your face, or a feeling of awe and appreciation. It can be a photograph of a calming nature scene, a bright-colored butterfly, a stunning flower, your baby, your loving spouse, your elderly grandmother, your devoted mentor, a memorable vacation, a family get-together, or a recent celebration. When you have collected between 50 and 100 photos, pictures, quotes, thoughts, and doodles, paste them all, in random order, onto a large poster. Hang this poster in a place where you will see it and be reminded every day of all the good in your life. The principle of hedonic adaptation is the effect of growing accustomed to good in our lives. When this happens, we no longer focus on it, and as time goes by, we derive less and less satisfaction from it. When we acquire something new, we are temporarily happier, less because of its intrinsic worth, beauty, or utility, than because we are focused on it. The research is definitive. Appreciation creates happiness. We already have everything that we need to be happy, but if we don't focus on it, then we don't derive any happiness from it. To become a more grateful and thus joyful person, we need only shift our attention to what we do have rather than on what we don't. The adage, "You don't appreciate what you have until you lose it," is more than just a quaint saying. It is a psychological truism. When you lose something of value, your focus shifts to it, and you are reminded of the joy that it brought you. It's more than ironic, though, that the pain we feel over its loss doesn't offset the pleasure it brought if we ignored it while we still had it. If your attention is on what's missing and what's not good, then you can be surrounded by all the good fortune, blessings, and material things in the world and never find happiness. Your focus creates your thoughts, and your thoughts create your emotions. Focus on the positive, and you will become a person who is filled with joy and gratitude. Focus on the negative, and you will become a person who is unhappy and unpleasant. It comes down to a choice. Are you going to live your life of appreciation or expectation? The power of focus is in play when it comes to the people in our lives as well, courtesy of the previously noted reticular activating system. Numerous studies prove what our own experiences have already shown us. A person intuitively senses whether we like him, even without a single word being exchanged. When you're speaking with a person who can bring out the worst in you, mentally focus on his positive traits, and he will sense that you like him, and in turn, he will be inclined to like you. Benjamin Franklin once said, "Search others for their virtues, thyself for thy vices." Not to be outdone, President Abraham Lincoln has been quoted as saying, "I don't like that man. I must get to know him better." If we look for the good in another person, we will find it. A positive groove. We can make the claim that we don't control our world or even some of our behavior, but our thoughts? Why would we choose to focus on what disturbs us rather than on what enthuses or invigorates us? In a word, habit. When we find ourselves in unproductive rumination, it can be useful to interrupt it. Recall that a pattern interrupt is a specific act that derails our train of thought to snap ourselves out of a cycle of negativity. While we are retraining our brain to focus on all the good, it is constructive to break free from the nasty habit many of us have of dwelling on the negative, which reinforces competing neural networks. We can't expect to control the first thought that enters our minds, but how much energy do we give to it to feed on? Will we focus on it, or will we divert our attention to something else? It's curious that we might choose to torture ourselves, reliving painful memories and focusing on all that is wrong, rather than to appreciate how far we've come, all that we have, and where we would like to go. 29. The Anger Games. Disappointment exists in the space between desire and reality, whereby the more reality falls short of our desire, the more disappointed we become. The equation: desire minus reality equals disappointment. Disappointment, however, is mitigated by one factor: expectation. The greater the gap between desire and expectation, the more disappointment we experience. Therefore, in each situation, regardless of our desire, the more our expectations align, meaning we expect as much, with reality, the less disappointment we experience. Can a person be happy to learn that a loved one has broken his ribs and punctured a lung? He can, if a few minutes earlier he learned that the injured was on life support but is now expected to make a full recovery. Does he feel angry? No. To the contrary, he's filled with gratitude and joy for one reason. Reality has now exceeded his expectations, and we'll presume desire. In the words of William Shakespeare, expectation is the root of all heartache. Expectations are a product of the ego and produce a toxic disappointment. When we manage our expectations, disappointment never fully matures into anger. Let's explain by differentiating between desire and expectation. Take, for instance, a parent whose child does poorly in school. Is the parent disappointed? Perhaps. Does the parent become angry with the child because he does poorly? It all depends on the parent's expectations of the child and his willingness to accept his child's limitations. If the child has a learning disability and the parent accepts this, then anger doesn't exist. However, if the parent refuses to acknowledge his child's limitations, poor grades only serve as a constant reminder of a reality, a diagnosis that the parent refuses to face. In that case, grades become a source of constant anger and frustration. When reality unfolds in accord with expectation, even though it falls short of desire, our emotional state is not corrupted by the ego. As long as we accept the reality, we won't become angry, regardless of the experience. We recall the four stages of grief discussed in Chapter 3, denial, anger, depression, and acceptance. We cannot expect that which we refuse to accept. Managing expectations. When reality meets or exceeds our expectations, the ego has no traction because, drum roll please, we do not feel afraid. Anger's roots in fear are of major significance. Anger manifests when life doesn't meet our expectations, when reality surprises us, shocks us. The ego doesn't like these unpleasant surprises because it needs to feel in control. Let's delve more deeply into the psychological mechanics. If someone rear-ends your car, you might understandably feel shaken and angry. But if you knew that morning that it would happen later that day, when the moment came, you would feel shaken, but much less surprised, and thus feel little or no anger. This is critical to understand. Anger exists because of a loss of control. Something happened that was not only undesirable, but unanticipated. By adjusting our expectations, we automatically eliminate the element of surprise in any given situation. Perhaps a milder example. A coworker jumps out from behind your desk. You get scared and a little angry. However, if you knew in advance where he was hiding and what his plan was, there would be no fear and hence no anger. In these hypothetical scenarios, several important factors mitigate our anger when we have advanced knowledge. 1. We reduce our shock and feeling of being out of control because we predicted it. We get to be right. Fulfilled expectations provide a layer of comfort, rather than fear or uneasiness, about even an unpleasant reality. 2. Without the element of fear, we can process the pending event more objectively and in a calm space. We can also see the ridiculous nature of an angry response and work through our feelings in advance. 3. In the words of Albert Einstein, in the middle of every difficulty lies opportunity. We have the luxury of time to reframe the experience in a greater context and try to find meaning in it, and perhaps look for ways to capitalize on it and turn it into an opportunity. We would not have had the presence of mind to do this in the moment. Let's play How Will I Be Triggered Today? We can't predict, let alone imagine, every anger-triggering scenario, but these situations and anger-provoking people do fall under some familiar themes. It's curious, if not completely ludicrous, that even though we repeatedly become angry at the same people in the same situation time and again, our ego acts as if each situation were new and unexpected, setting us up each and every time. Refusing to recognize this process is like living in la-la land. It isn't reality. Unrealized expectations are nothing more than premeditated resentment. Why, you may ask, don't we naturally adjust our expectations after experiencing these surprises day after day, year after year, decade after decade? A good question. Ask your ego. If the forecaster predicts a snowstorm and you are planning on a picnic at the beach, you're not living in reality, and you're setting yourself up for utter frustration and disappointment. A wise person would plan on a different activity. Of course, forecasts being what they are, we may only get a light dusting of snow, and so your ski trip might be canceled. Fine. At least you walked out of the house with a scarf and gloves rather than sunblock and flip-flops. We are not talking about predicting reality, but staying in reality. Here is what we can guarantee with relative accuracy. Today's forecast, it will be an imperfect day. You are an imperfect person living an imperfect life, and things in your day will be imperfect, and that's all okay. In fact, it's more than okay. It's a perfect opportunity for you to develop a greater sense of emotional resiliency, self-control, and self-respect. It is an opportunity to show the world that you are in control of yourself, and in the process, improve almost every aspect of your life and your relationships. We might feel disrespected today. Someone may cut in front of us at the supermarket or on the highway, or ignore our phone call or email. We might feel embarrassed, or someone might yell at us. Today we might feel hurt, helpless, or both. We might feel rejected, lonely, sad, or all three. Today someone might do something that makes no sense, something completely illogical and irrational. Expect it. Someone may try to take advantage of us today or insult us. We might witness an injustice. Someone may inconvenience us. A goal may be delayed. We might realize something unpleasant about ourselves or a loved one. Another person's act may cause us to question the relationship or ourselves. We might become uncomfortable or feel unwanted. Again, this is not about expecting the worst or waiting for the other shoe to drop. Rather, to quote an oft-repeated axiom, hope for the best and plan for the worst. To plan means that we are cognizant that the shoe drops many, many times every single day in many different ways, and we can be surprised and get angry, or each time can become an opportunity to fortify our emotional health and transform our character. 30. Game Day. Becoming anger-free must be your number one priority. Don't think of this as a hobby where you dabble only when you're inspired and it's convenient. Neural networks are competitive, so you need to activate the new response with more frequency, intensity, and duration than your anger-prone network. To help us along, we want to track our progress, because if you can't measure it, you can't change it. Moreover, studies show that recording and reviewing your behavior proves effective across a wide swath of areas. For example, dieters who kept a food journal lost twice as much weight over a 6-month period as those who didn't, and follow-up studies conclude that they kept it off. The simple act of writing everything down, A, motivates people to consume less, and B, makes it difficult for them to ignore their slip-ups. Keeping a journal or charting your progress toward anger elimination is a way to move the emphasis from a single incidence of behavior to an overall pattern. It is easier, too, to sustain progress if you see evidence in writing. Memory is far more biased when you feel discouraged and you have a harder time recalling your successes. In addition, tracking your progress allows you to adjust your tactics because you can examine what's working and what's not working. While you may be unwavering in your pursuit, you want to be flexible in your approach. First, we want a clear and definitive goal, and write it down. Just because you're motivated doesn't mean that you have a clear purpose. Formulating a precise definition of what you want to accomplish helps you focus on relevant activities and avoid diversions that distance you from your objectives. In fact, studies find that people are, on average, 10 times more likely to succeed by making a firm resolution to a specific commitment. Additionally, the strength of your commitment is magnified, 42% more likely to achieve your goal when you write it down, review your statement, and state aloud your commitment to your objective several times throughout the day. And sending weekly updates to a friend can double your rate of success. Second, success requires that for a specified period, you don't reconsider the decision to express your anger in any way. Precious energy trickles out every time you consider, is this a time to get angry? There are, of course, those who would claim that when properly expressed, anger may be appropriate. In fairness, there are a number of studies to support this position, and yet, for our purposes, the debate is irrelevant, which is why throughout this book we have been speaking about anger in absolute terms. We recall from Chapter 5 that emotions help to energize our direction and motivate proper behavior, but only when we first see through the lens of the intellect. Let's say that 1% of the time anger is the proper response. In the heat of the moment, we are not able to make that call, and we will decide that anger is necessary closer to 99% of the time. Might you choose to remain calm only to conclude after the fact that anger was indeed called for? Perhaps. But wouldn't you rather be right 99% of the time than 1% of the time? By taking anger off the table, we are more inclined to reframe the situation and seek solutions rather than to focus on the problem. King Solomon instructs, "Do not be eager in your heart to be angry, for anger resides in the bosom of fools." Commentators explain that a fool's anger is readily available and accessible, while a wise person stores his anger out of reach, so that by the time he gets to it, he has already calmed himself down. Therefore, in order to strengthen the proper neural networks, regardless of how you feel, the display of anger will be unconditionally off the table as a viable response. Having a set time frame is also helpful, because you will view whatever gains you've made appropriately as gains, rather than considering yourself a failure because you didn't succeed in completely eradicating the behavior. Start with 24 hours, or start with 5 minutes, but start and make the goal realistic. Anger has 5 main measurable components: frequency, duration, intensity, trigger, and expression. You can chart it any way you like, and again, don't underestimate the power of keeping a written record of your progress. Frequency. How often do you get angry? Does it happen every hour? Does it happen every day? Maybe it happens several times one day and then does not even happen for several days. Keep track of the sheer number of times you feel angry. Duration. How long do you stay angry? Take note of how long it takes you to reclaim yourself and to snap out of your state. Intensity. This is a little harder to measure, but you will become more aware of how intense the episodes are once you begin to keep track of them. Using a scale from 1 to 5 can help quantify your feelings. Trigger. There are always certain situations that will more easily spark our anger. This is something you should measure because you might just be surprised at the catalyst. Also, take time to identify the underlying fear at the root of the episode in order to work through it, using the process in Chapter 26. Expression. What did you do with the anger? This is not a one-size-fits-all category. If you are prone to suppressing your feelings, did you choose to express yourself more openly and honestly? If you usually explode, were you able to contain yourself and calmly exit the situation? Regarding expression, we have identified 3 levels of anger. 1, feeling anger in the moment. 2, acting out of anger with aggressive expression. And 3, resentment from unresolved anger. The ideal, of course, is to enjoy a wide perspective where fewer and fewer situations get caught in the ego's net. Still, if you are unable to avoid feeling angry at the time, progress can be had by restraining your anger. All too often, in the heat of the moment and out of anger, we may say or do something that further increases our feelings of embarrassment or shame. We are then forced to double down, and our anger turns into rage. We lose ourselves to our emotions because we cannot bear the pain of accepting what we are doing right now, which was in response to something else entirely. The ego goes into survival mode and re-ups the ante again and again. The bottom line, do whatever is necessary to avoid rage, the uncontrolled expression of anger. Regardless of your thoughts and behavior in the moment, wiping the slate clean to rid yourself of lingering resentment, guilt, or shame is a powerful, purposeful step toward an anger-free life. As we noted, taking responsibility is not about being perfect. It's what we do when we discover that we have faltered and how we move forward to make things right after we have done wrong. You're going to live anger-free. Get excited. Our success coalesces around one requirement, joy. Joy energizes our decision to live a life that is anger-free. You have every reason to be excited because you're not giving anything up and you're not losing out on anything. You are gaining in every way, maximizing your potential and actualizing your dreams and becoming a happier, healthier person who appreciates all of the good that life has to offer you. Special note to listeners. Although the choices we make during our lives have a strong impact on our emotional stability, severe mental illness, including anger management issues, may result from serious trauma or a genetic disposition. This mental state could affect a person's basic life functioning so significantly that his or her thoughts and behaviors fall outside the scope of genuine choice. Just as some people are physically disabled, others are emotionally impaired through no fault of their own. They neither choose nor cause their sickness, and to label them lazy or selfish is not only reprehensible, but mistaken. The tools and techniques in this book have shown to be life-transforming for many people, but others will benefit from the direct guidance of a mental health care professional. At what point our free will emerges remains a subject of ongoing philosophical, psychological, and biological debate, but the indisputable beginning of all change comes when we make a conscious decision to accept personal responsibility. This means that we put our ego aside and seek whatever help we need to regain control of our lives. We hope you've enjoyed Never Get Angry Again, a Macmillan audio production from St. Martin's Press. Text copyright 2017 by David J. Lieberman. Production copyright 2017 by Macmillan Audio. Post-production by John Marshall Media. All rights reserved.